There are problems, some technical, some political. But who's looking for solutions? And who will pay for them? How will they be paid for? A search of R&D projects in the U.S. government reveals nothing of magnitude comparable to most weapons systems or space developments, but there are small and growing efforts. One such program is in the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which is elected to put a large fraction of its small $55 million R&D budget into a housing-oriented demonstration project called Operation Breakthrough. Alan Siegel, director of the Environmental Factors and Public Utilities Division of HUD, explains the approaches being used in two areas of new technology.
Operation Breakthrough is a program to tackle the constraints that are limiting the housing supply. And this involves quite a complex operation of some 22 housing system producers providing alternative industrialized housing system methods, a method of aggregating a market so that the producers can find a more easy way of selling their systems, techniques to try and tackle the problems of the highly differentiated building codes throughout the country. In addition, part of the activity involves demonstration of these 22 systems on 9 prototype sites throughout the country for testing purposes, demonstration, sales purposes. Our objectives on these sites are to be able to show, for example, that several different of these systems can be put together into a compatible environment. So our sites, in a planning purpose, are to be innovative in its land use. And we wish to provide a high-quality environment for living on those sites. And then my office was faced with a goal, get rid of the same old garbage truck. And I think that's the simplest way of stating what our objective was. And also to concern ourselves again with other types of environmental concerns that utilities systems may be able to make a contribution to. Well, getting underway, we conducted some feasibility studies and have made the decision to begin the design work and hardware procurements for 2 kinds of demonstrations. First of all, to get rid of the same old garbage truck on 2 of our sites, we're planning the capital intensive investment of a pneumatic waste collection system, which I like to call the garbage slurper. It basically collects the waste from individual vertical trash collection chutes that are familiar to high-rise housing. But instead of having a compactor and incinerator on the bottom, you basically have an air-driven sewer which just collects all the waste from all these buildings onto one point on the site where we can compact it or incinerate it and remove or and basically prepare it into a condition for economical removal from the site. We also provide another benefit in that the basement designs no longer have to be concerned with the problems of what do you do in the way of being able to move in and out of the basement collection rooms. You just don't have to bring your vehicles into the basement to do this removal process. The second type of system which we are planning to install at a single site is a total energy system to provide us with electricity at very high reliability, which will make a contribution to our problems of energy utilization by using the waste heat of the thermodynamic conversion process to be used for domestic water heating and for building heating. In addition to that, we will not be having high summer loads because we would be using absorption cooling and some mechanical compressive systems is our current plans. One can foresee if one is trying to, in the particular case of total energy and solid waste, where we are getting some interactions already, we're using our electricity at low use periods to run the trash collection system. We would be using the same building space for the mechanical equipment. That when one gets to bigger systems, one could begin to get a better recycling system that would allow for either isolated development activities or perhaps to at least reduce the load on the surrounding utility infrastructure in, say, urban renewal sites. But in any case, we do have to get our hands dirty to find out how well these things work. It's not just ourselves. The private sector has to be involved. These systems have to basically make economic sense.
The key seems to be to provide incentive to industry to develop profitable products, which will at the same time cut both housing costs and pollution. The much-advertised economies of scale may not always apply to areas such as power generation. If, for example, the clean incineration of waste in a housing project can provide fuel at zero or even negative costs. Self-contained, fully planned new urban centers might, for example, provide a better solution to an expanding population's needs than continued suburbanization around existing overtaxed and decaying civic centers. One cannot overstress the economic aspects of environment management. It is, after all, economics which causes industry to load our lakes and streams with fouling chemicals. But it is also economics which has recently led to the processing of some of this wastewater to remove valuable chemicals from it. One of the earliest examples was the discharge of the industrial chemical byproduct, ethylene glycol. Some observant fellows saw that the river water near the discharge point did not freeze, and thus what we now know as permanent automotive antifreeze was born from a former waste product. There's other waste waiting to be salvaged. Even the thermal pollution of water by excess heat from power plant condensers represents discarded energy. Perhaps someday it may be possible to convert more of this heat into electrical energy. To show just how important the economics of management of our natural resources can be, Professor J. L. Knetch presents a hypothetical example of what we might call land pollution, giving us some idea of the setting of economic values.
For example, rather than cuss the economic system under which we live, I would like to see us make far greater use of it. This is the basic market system of the American economy, and for that matter, most of the Western economies. This is the system that provides the incentives and restraints of resource use. What we need to do is to rig the incentive structure such that we provide the incentives that are consistent, first of all, with the economic system we have, but more importantly, that make the goals of the individual consistent with the goals of the society at large. What we have in the pollution problem is the divergence of these two goals. It pays the polluter to dump stuff in the water or to destroy a landscape to the detriment of society at large. What I'm suggesting is that we ought to try to make these things coincide. I'd like to illustrate what I mean by this by using an example of a land pollution problem. And this is the one of the misallocation of resources or pollution, if you will, associated with coastal estuaries. That is, the bays, estuaries, salt marshes, and so forth along our ocean shores. And these areas, incidentally, are not without interest to the electric the power industry. Now, there are several types of environmental degradation associated with estuaries. They involve, first of all, pollution. The thermal effects are an important cause of pollution in these areas. Changes in the water flow from one reason or another. Or a still another one, and one that I really want to talk about in terms of illustrating the an approach to the problem, is the one of landfill. Well, what happens here, basically, is that someone has, a salt marsh, which is of very little particular value to him, and this marsh gets filled in, thereby destroying important ecological values associated with the marsh in its marsh state. Now, this is a form of land pollution that has been of considerable concern. The problem of the externalities, there are a number of externalities, just one will serve to illustrate the case, and that is that most of the important species of fish, as I understand the situation, hatch out in the ocean, come in as young, feed in these coastal estuaries, and after they grow up, go out in the ocean and get caught. If you destroy the estuary here, you in effect destroy significant wildlife fish values in this case. But there are other values associated with these estuaries as well. The difficulty is that the landowner cannot collect for this kind of a value. Even though if I own a marsh, the fact that it is extremely productive for society at large, because this marsh is where the fish grow up, I am in no position, my property right does not extend all the way to the middle of the ocean, so in effect I cannot collect for the benefit, that is the productivity of my resource. Consequently, I'm tempted when somebody comes along who wants to fill it, to sell out, in fact this is what happens, sell out very cheaply, to a land developer who then fills in the marsh. It seems to me what is really happening here is simply that the land is underpriced. Now, prices in a market economy such as our own perform an important function. That is, they shift resources into their most beneficial use. But in order to perform this function, prices have to reflect the productivity that you give up. All prices in the economy perform this function. What we have in the case of my estuary is that when you fill in an estuary, we are not compensating for the value lost in terms of the fish value and the open space and wildlife and a whole bunch of other things associated with this. What I would suggest might be worth considering is that we assess the environmental values that would be foregone by an alteration of the estuary, and to then put a tax on that land that anyone who wants to buy the land for development purposes, that is, alter the land use, would be required to pay. What this is doing is saying to the potential changer of the environment, if you want to change the environment, you have to bid away, for whatever use you have in mind, you have to bid away this resource from its alternative employment. In this case, its alternative employment happens to be in the feeding of fish. If I'm going to go into a marsh and completely destroy all environmental values, I would pay the highest tax. If I go into a marsh and change it such that I don't only partially destroy these environmental values, the tax would be subsequently lowered. And if, in fact, I were to get a hold of a marsh and increase its productivity for environmental effects, I would also advocate then a negative tax or, in fact, a payment. This, of course, is very similar to the proposals for effluent charges in the case of water pollution. I would also suggest, incidentally, that the funds collected from this might in part be used to compensate local jurisdictions for tax revenue losses, local government expenses, that a more equitable sharing of the cost, I think, would result from this. We would provide a incentive, therefore, to become far more knowledgeable about what things are more valuable than other things, and also, on the other side, what technologies can be evolved which are less damaging to these environmentals than the others.
Painful as it may be to the spirit of free enterprise and land speculation, complex taxes and tariffs may need to be established to provide the balance against man's never-ending desire for personal or corporate gain. The ravaged hills of Appalachia are mute testimony to this need. Eventually, our legislators must fully exploit the economic means of solution to these problems, no matter how insistent the opposition. They will need the assistance of highly skilled systems analysts who can establish consistent and equitable formulas as bases for legislation. Most of the speakers you heard earlier have been dealing more with projection and speculation than with the pragmatics of environmental management. Sound and valuable as these proposals may be, their scope often lies beyond that which the individual citizen engineer or even the individual company can implement. Our final speaker brings problems down to a more personal, even a manageable level, by pointing out the needs and opportunities for technology at the urban level. Lewis Blair, a staff member of the Urban Institute, knows from personal experience that simple, even small-scale technological advances may make a big difference when effectively introduced.
When I was running for city council election a year or so ago, the public works department in our city was forced to cut back on the garbage collection services. They just couldn't get enough collectors. People were balking about accepting jobs at low wages. Conditions were very bad, the absentee rates were high, turnover rates were high, just couldn't get enough people for it and had to cut back. So along with the rumors of rats circulating around town, Lewis Blair went circulating around town, knocking on doors, promising to do something about improving trash collection. And as a matter of fact, 11 days before the election, the volunteer fire department in our city had its annual Memorial Day parade, and all the candidates were invited to appear, and most of them rode in convertibles. I chose instead to ride in the parade on a garbage truck with huge signs on either side that said, "Lyrics player will do all he can for better garbage collection." And then it was just a matter of staying quiet until the election, which was successful. These successful candidates then had to think of some way to live up to our campaign promise of improving collection. And on the suggestion of our director of public works, we thought that something that was very simple and very elementary, yet it was an application of modern technology, and it was the use of a polyethylene plastic bag. Nothing very elaborate. An old technology that had been around, oh, many, many years. Been fabricated into plastic bags, 7 or 8 years ago. Yet it was very slow in getting to local governments. But it had a tremendous impact on our government. The streets are cleaner, hadn't had high absentee rates, turnover rates, morale is good, cost of collection services has gone down, citizen satisfaction has soared. There are a number of other areas, in addition to just trash collection, that could use modern technology devices. Infrared devices for firemen to point around a room to detect where fire is burning behind a wall. Better gas masks for fighting fires releasing noxious fumes. An inexpensive combination fire burglar detector that perhaps would report to the operations room of a police station. Acoustic or seismic devices for park surveillance, night vision equipment for police, or inspection equipment to detect illegal sanitary sewer taps. This is a real problem. In the traffic area, for instance, an automatic traffic sensor that would automatically measure the speed of vehicles and photograph the speeders. It might sound unfair to you, as it does to me and the others of us who drive sports cars, yet it costs $100,000 a year to maintain one radar unit 24 hours a day. Now, these are problems that I've observed in my little town, and I think they're common to many, many other cities and urban counties in the U.S. Certainly from the city standpoint, they're the institutional problems. City's just reluctant to take up anything new. People are afraid they might lose jobs. There's a little climate for innovation. Sometimes even the unions are reluctant to allow any changes. Then there are the purchasing factors. Cities just tend to buy or keep buying the products that they know about. There's the risk factor. Cities rarely want to take up anything new that might fail. And certainly, being a city councilman, I'm well aware of the risks of failure. They're far greater than the rewards of success. And then there's the distrust factor. Cities are just distrustful of industry's proposals, by and large. They've gotten burned too many times on new things that look like they're going to save the city, and they've been purchased, and they just haven't worked out well. Cities also really just can't keep up with what's going on. There's a lack of knowledge. If a product can be shown to be worthwhile, if it has a favorable cost-benefit ratio, the cost then is not so important. The city can afford it if the benefits are good. I don't think we have to worry so much about the cost of the new equipment. And there certainly are a number of factors that could help in introducing new equipment. There's a strong need, as we mentioned, to reduce expenses. If something's been used in another city with success, neighboring cities are very anxious to pick it up. They want to try to keep up with the Jones city, so to speak. And then there are the professionals in the cities, the chief of police, director of public works, the director of planning, who belong to professional associations. And by and large, these are enlightened groups which have a considerable influence in the city that perhaps can be reached. There's little assurance, really, of a large production run, even if a product is good. You can't just make a product for Washington and hope to break even on it. You've got to sell it across the country. But it's been very difficult for industry to sell nationwide on new products, and they're understandably reluctant to invest in the development and production of products with such little assurance of their selling. I think industry is also faced really with a lack of knowledge of how the city operates. what its needs are, what it can accept, what it can do, and what it can buy. There's been very poor salesmanship on the part of industry. John Parker of Parker Associates over in Bethesda recently cited an interesting example of some firms that tried to market a new product in the traffic control area. And it was the digital reprogrammable traffic control system. And very briefly, a reprogrammable system is one which seems to have the advantage over the current analog system of increasing traffic throughput, reducing travel time, and reducing accidents. A number of firms rushed to get into it. And here are the cases of five firms, which are fairly typical of traffic control, and I'm afraid of other areas. One firm rejected the idea of the digital traffic control system in favor of the existing analog systems that it already had, but it adopted more aggressive selling policies. Another firm went into the digital traffic control system and marketed it, but they never demonstrated how it would work. A third firm marketed the old analog programs, but just put a different label on it and said it was the new digital system. A fourth firm came out with something that was outrageously expensive and hadn't been demonstrated either. And then there was a fifth firm, which had been around for a long time, which decided, well, not to get into the hardware business at all, but they'd just go into the consulting business. And they would show other firms why they shouldn't buy any of this equipment at all. Now, I think this shows you just how an example of how one piece of modern technology gets abused and why it never really gets brought to bear in the city environment, and why so many cities are reluctant to take up anything new because they've had experiences with companies like this. There are a number of mechanisms that we can consider that would bring about this technology application. The needs are so great for the cities, and there's so many different areas begging modern technology applications that I think we should really consider a number of organizations. And the ones in conclusion that I would like to propose are a sort of a demonstration grant program, which a grant might be made by the federal government jointly to a local government, a manufacturer, and a professional association to design, build, and test a prototype working model of an application of some modern technology to a specific local government problem. The local government and the professional association could lead in specifying the requirements, not only for that particular city, but for the cities across the country, which all had a similar problem. The manufacturer could lead in applying the existing technology. And then finally, the city and the professional association could then evaluate the operation of the prototype in the test bed city. Such a procedure, I think, would frequently lead to successful product development. And the association could publicize the device among its members who are in the various cities, and I think could create a strong demand and a strong market for this product. Some of the costs of the demonstration program might even be recovered through a licensing agreement or sales of the development rights. Other mechanisms that might be useful would be a product evaluation center, something like Consumers Report, or Consumers Union rather, that objectively evaluates new products for the city and says the costs and the benefits of them. But it would be one that the cities could trust as being objective and not one necessarily tied in with industry. A third thing might be some consulting service or a technical information service. Lots of cities have technical problems, but they just don't know who to turn to get advice on them. Some local governments are using modern technology, but no other governments really hear about it. There's very poor communications among cities, say, on the West Coast and the East Coast. Perhaps some national publication could help. And finally, I think some industry local government exchange program in which members from industry and civil servants from local government change jobs. Industry sees what the problems are really in the city. City people see some of the technologies that might be available.
One lesson from Mr. Blair's experiences may be that the best way of dealing with politicians is to join them. certainly there is a great need for technically trained officials as part of our urban management teams. In the brief time we've had available on this soundings cassette, it was not possible to cover the technical details of the many aspects of environmental management. In fact, we haven't touched at all on several important areas. For example, acoustical noise pollution. The problems here lie mainly in noise from jet aircraft and high-speed highways. Electrical engineers have always led the way in acoustical instrumentation. The Audio and Electroacoustics Group in IEEE is a focal point for that area. Electrical engineers in this area have also made important contributions to reduction or suppression of noise, for example, in many of the machines used for input and output of digital computers. The area of electromagnetic spectrum pollution is another one in which EEs know the technology. This area, at least at present, is of little concern to the average citizen, unless his television reception is polluted. The problem here, as seen by specialists in the field, is the congestion of popular parts of the spectrum. A striking example is in the very low-frequency range. As pointed out at the 1970 IEEE International Convention by Wilford Dean, Jr., a member of the Executive Office of the President, in the 14 to 27 kilohertz band, there are 258 internationally licensed transmitters in operation in 17 countries. In this band, which permits intercontinental surface wave transmission, each of the users, some are in the megawatt class, is in effect granted only 52 cycles of full-time available bandwidth. But modern technology through satellite communications can and has provided alternatives to cable or very low-frequency transmission for worldwide communications. Naturally, those areas of pollution which most concern the average citizen are the most visible or apparent ones, primarily air and water pollution. At first glance, these areas might seem to be solely the provinces of civil, sanitary, or chemical engineers. This is by no means the case. Electrical technology is already being applied in both areas. For example, electrodialysis, in which dissolved ions are removed from water by electric fields applied in thin membrane environments, is an accepted technology for desalting brackish water. Air pollution is greatly reduced in many coal-burning power plants by electrostatic precipitators which trap particulate matter after giving it an electric charge. But in both pollution areas, technology improvements are needed. The low-sulfur coals, which now reduce sulfur dioxide production in many urban areas, also reduce the effectiveness of particle precipitation because of the effect of sulfur on chargeability of the particles. As Hugh Hefner has pointed out, electrical engineers have for many years conducted research in plasma and laser technology, both of which could make major contributions to air pollution problems. The problems of environmental pollution are many and difficult. We agree with Dr. Hefner that EEs can and will make major contributions. Already, several IEEE groups have focused attention on these areas. For example, Geoscience Electronics, in its July 1970 transactions, a special issue on environmental pollution instrumentation, and Systems Science and Cybernetics Group, in a special October 1970 transactions on urban and public systems. We expect these and other groups will continue attention in this area. For a readable review of the problems of pollution, we would also suggest getting a copy of the American Chemical Society's Cleaning Our Environment, the Chemical Basis for Action, which may be obtained for $2.75 from the American Chemical Society at 1155 16th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. 20036. Not only does the management of our natural environment present us with some of the most complex systems and technological problems of our times, but ultimately the future of mankind must depend on our finding practical and economically justifiable solutions to these problems. This is Editor Walt Beam asking for your comments and suggestions on this and future issues of IEEE Soundings.